Spy on the World, the New World Report with Professor Evan Ellis of the U.S. Army War College Strategic Studies Institute. I'm John Batchelor. Two headlines about Nicaragua. You will recall the Ortega family dominates Nicaragua and has very clearly established that this is a dictatorship that enforces itself with brutality, cruelty, and murder. Now we have this headline. Nicaraguan political prisoners' families seek their release after others free. What? The relatives of 35 political prisoners in Nicaragua called for their release days after 222 others in the same category were freed and expelled to the United States following a surprise deal with Washington. Professor, this story is both promising because I understand a number of these political prisoners have been reunited with their families and they're significant speakers for freedom in Nicaragua, so therefore they're no longer languishing in jails under what are said to be extreme conditions and now able to work from the outside. But why does this happen? What is the Ortega gangster domination mean by releasing political prisoners? Thank you.
Under the Sandinistas, that you've always had a degree of political and other repression. First, when they came to power by force in the 1979 revolution, and then when Ortega returned to power after a political pact with one of the previous other presidential figures in 2007. However, as the Sandinistas slowly gained power and through corruption took over control of Congress and the various other institutions, that repression increased. But it really came to a head in April 2018, when nationwide protests began, really presenting a challenge to the regime over really people frustrated with the corruption. It started again over an issue of healthcare, but it really spread to a broad variety of issues. And so from that point, the Ortegas basically began trying to repress their way out of this. And that had resulted in hundreds and hundreds of political prisoners and as well as deaths and torture across the nation. However, little by little, the fountains of public resistance were shut down. You've had something like 2,000 different NGOs who have frankly been outlawed and shut down, including Mother Teresa's own organization. There's been repression against the Catholic Church, which was one of the big public forms of expression and discussion, including some of the more outspoken bishops, such as the Archbishop of Matagalpa, Rolando Alvarez, who was sentenced literally to 26 years in prison for opposing the regime. And so what you saw, and the other thing that, of course, has happened is you had the fraudulent elections of about a year ago in which the Ortegas outlawed all the competing parties, and then the follow-on municipal elections just this past November in which the Sandinista Party literally won 153 of 153, literally every single seat in all of Nicaragua. So literally the space for public opposition has been just eliminated. Now, in that, the most recent, the release of 222 prisoners was basically Ortega stripped their citizenship away. He's trying to kind of cast them as puppets or instruments of the United States. And so they were forced to renounce their citizenship. They are put on a plane and essentially sent to the United States. Several actually refused because they didn't want to be kind of used and propagandized that way. They preferred to stay in prison. But to the credit of the NICA community in the United States, within literally 3 days, those 222 homes were found for all of those people to be resettled in the United States to continue their lives as best as they can here. But as you also pointed out, we were talking about Haiti before, just with that repression and the collapse of the economy and other thing, you've literally had over 200,000 Nicaraguans since those 2018 protests fleeing the country. And again, many of which trying to either go to Costa Rica next door or ultimately to come to the United States and elsewhere. But it's really, with the Ortegas, Nicaragua is very quickly becoming kind of like Kim Jong-un in North Korea, the so to speak, the hermit kingdom of Central America.
Some good news. We're not all catastrophe, and this appears to be good news. I'm going to be careful because the professor's here. Colombians took to the streets across the country's major cities to support economic and social reforms put forward by President Gustavo Petro. He's looking to reform labor, pensions, and health care. All good news, Professor. Gustavo Petro is surprising. a man with a colorful background, including violence and terrorism, but now in the presidency, looks to be enjoying popular support. Colombia is a longstanding close ally of the United States, and continues, is this good news? Petro is acting pretty much like a Teddy Roosevelt figure. He wants to reform everything.
Well, John, I would argue that Colombia is still very deeply divided, and there are deep divisions over his legislative agenda, which is a very much a state agenda. So on the one side, you have his security agenda, his total peace agenda, which is trying to create a space for groups like the ELN and the dissidents of the FARC and even some of the other what they call armed organized groups or GAL to get them to the peace table. And a lot of controversy about that. But at the same time, there have been some concerns. He does have a legislative majority. So his historic pact, the March elections before he came to power, basically gave his bloc a strong possibility, but still in the minority. But other kind of key Colombian parties like the Conservative Party and the Liberal Party have kind of joined together, kind of wanting a piece of the action in that coalition. Now, a very skillful legislator, Roy Barreras, is trying to kind of pull that legislative agenda together, all of the different kind of government statist programs that Petro has. And so last year, he put forward a very important tax reform, a proposal which would have increased taxes. The next big step that we're seeing right now is the healthcare reform. And frankly, the problem many Colombians would tell you is that although there are problems with the healthcare system, Colombian healthcare isn't broken. In many ways, it compares favorably to the situation with U.S. healthcare. But there's a desire to basically merge the public and private healthcare in a way that would increase public healthcare workers' salaries, that would eliminate intermediaries. Some say that intermediaries bring efficiency, but Petro sees it as a source of difficulty. And then on the board after that is a reform to Colombia's private pension system, some labor reforms in terms of pay, other things on the table in the coming months, possibly demands for free university access, subsidies to the poor and elderly, et cetera, et cetera. And so what happened with this recent march, actually last week you had 500 teachers who tried to overrun and occupy Congress, not unlike what happened with Bolsonaro's followers in Brazil, although unsuccessfully. But what you have this week is Petro basically saying, I want my supporters to come out and show that there is popular support for these things that I'm trying to push through, to basically try to intimidate or energize Congress into supporting that by showing that popular mobilization. And so that's what this march was about this past week. I would say that right now he has the votes in numbers, but there are deep controversies over this bill. And so it's not clear whether Roy Barreras is going to be able to pull off his magic right now. Barreras has actually been suffering from cancer, as basically Petro's kind of key magic maker in the Congress. But certainly for Petro's non-security agenda, these new things after tax reform, healthcare reform, and then coming with pension reform and other things, these are kind of his kind of key signature items for the change that he wants to bring to Colombia.
The gems of the 19th and 20th century in South America include Venezuela, which is now darkness visible, and Colombia, we've spoken of, and Argentina, celebrated for its steak. I understand, Professor, you can't order a salad in Buenos Aires. It's not permitted. You have to have a second steak. So we go to news from Argentina that requires interpretation. Argentina's center-left president, Alberto Fernandez, intends to elevate the country's current spy chief to lead the cabinet. A reshuffle as the embattled Peronese government looks to win back voters ahead of the October general election. It's a very significant election coming October, but the inflation approaches 100%. Why a spy chief to answer what is clearly an economic crisis?
Great question, John. So first of all, as you pointed out, that the key mark on the wall is the October 2023 election, which will be for the presidency, Congress, and also the governors of most of the provinces, much like the state elections for state governors that we have in the United States. And so there's a lot of change going on right now. Argentina right now is going through the process of basically its primary season. You have different primaries taking place in different times, basically from the early spring as we approach the elections. And what's interesting right now is that especially the two big coalitions, the governing coalition, the Front for for All, or the Frente de Todos, as well as the opposition Juntos para Cambio. Just like in the United States, the people who are interested are, you know, pretty wide open. And so I would just mention that at the presidential level, you have the vice president that many people thought would run, Cristina Fernandez, who is not going to run. But it's not clear whether in his own party, whether Alberto will run. There's some talk about the economics minister, Sergio Massa, who's probably even more popular than Alberto, may run for the governing coalition. And there's talk of others. And similarly, in the opposition, you have the former security minister, Patricia Bullrich. You have the current Buenos Aires mayor, Horacio Larreta. You have Mauricio Macri, the previous president. You have the former governor of Buenos Aires province, Mario Vidal. And so you have all of this national level posturing of who's going to be the president. But you also have the question of who's going to basically run for the different governorships. And so last time the governing party in the last local elections just got massacred because of frustration over inflation and things like that. And so this time, key Argentine leaders who want to essentially run for the governor or run for other things, they have to leave behind their current positions in order to do that. So in the case of the head of the Federal Investigative Services, AFI, Agustin Rossi, what you had there is that he is being brought in to take over the cabinet so that Juan Manzur can basically run for the governorship of Tucumán, again, a key province. And so the idea is to try to kind of shift things around so that the biggest hitters within Peronism can have a shot at winning those gubernatorial elections in October, which, again, is part of the broader battle that has to do with the national elections, which will also include the presidential election in October and possibly a November runoff. And so at the end of the day, Argentina is going to become increasingly important because this could be one of the first countries, if the opposition gets their act together, in which you could see a turn from the left back to the right. But certainly the Peronists are posturing themselves to try to prevent that from happening, both at the governorship level as well as the national level.
Peru, more trouble for President Dina Boluarte, who inherited the post as vice president when the president, elected president Castillo, was jailed. Now this, Peruvian President Dina Boluarte pledged a crackdown on, quote, narco-terrorism, speaking at a funeral of seven police officers gunned down in an area where drug traffickers operate in alliance with the remnants of the Shining Path militants. So it wasn't enough that Castillo is in jail over the protest of significant leaders like AMLO of Mexico, nor that the mines are threatened with disruption, especially the large copper mines, nor that the legislature is opposing the president's wish to bring elections forward for legitimacy. Now we have narco-terrorism. Is this an older story, Professor? And I shouldn't say this is a new wave. They're just dealing with it. And the violence, the murder of seven policemen brings attention to it again, but it's not something that just popped up.
John, these are all interlinked stories, but going back to the power of Pedro Castillo and the nationwide protest, for example, what we remember is that part of that power was the traditionally neglected people of the Andean highlands in the jungle region. So Castillo's home province of Cajamarca, who felt kind of neglected and not represented by the by Limeño politics in the capital, and thus the frustration that expressed itself in places like Juliaca, that Castillo's removal was a disempowerment of them. Another part of that disempowerment goes all the way back to Peru's very bloody civil war, which started really formally in 1980 with a Shining Path. Something like 69,000 people were killed in that bloody war that, had problems on all sides. But thanks in large part to policies of the previous Fujimori government and others, little by little, Shining Path was defeated, except there was a residual in one of those remote, neglected areas, a place in the mountains where the Apurimac, Mantaro, and Eni rivers come together. So it's known as the Vrine. And so, again, think of this as another one of those kind of forgotten spaces. It's at the intersection between multiple provinces, has traditionally not had good access to markets, not received a lot of government attention. And so again, in that particular place where you've had Senator Luminoso and others operating. So what happened with the police? This was one of just ongoing series of action. The particular group that's claiming responsibility, the MPCP, is believed to have maybe about 150 people in an area where Sendero Luminoso still operates with maybe a couple hundred, but in a broader kind of criminalized, narco-dominant, coca-growing economy. And so again, they're actually near a pretty big military base in Pichari. You had this ambush of seven police officers. I'd like to say this is new, but this happens all the time. The military, even in recent years, had set up a special military command of the Vrime, the CE Vrime, again, to try to have kind of a coordinated military police response to some of this. Even the previous government had done an operation against one of the part of that highland, a place called Biscatan, to kind of go after one of the refuges of these groups. But again, it's very difficult terrain, neglected people, a place with a relatively limited state presence, limited economic opportunity. And so this is really kind of a symptom of what we continue to see, the story of two Perus and how that's expressed itself in political terms and economic terms and in terms of narco-terrorism. And here in this case, in terms of these pseudo-insurgent groups.
Professor Evan Ellis, U.S. Army War College. The New World Report. We're headed to the Amazon. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
We all make choices. When it comes to alcohol, kids make choices whether to drink or not.
Bye, Dad.
Bye-bye.
Remember, I'm going to Alex's party tonight and sleeping over.
Hey, Em, have a seat for a second. Remind me about that party again.
And adults make choices whether to talk about it. That's true of parents and every other trusted adult in a kid's life. Kids want to know our expectations when it comes to alcohol and other drugs. They want guidance and honest answers to their questions. And it makes a difference when the message is consistent and part of everyday conversations. So talk with your kids and help lead them on a positive path. Because when you talk, they hear you. For more information about talking with your kids about underage use of alcohol and other drugs, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
Unlike other health concerns, mental illness is not always easy to see. Depression won't show up on an eye chart, and you can't measure it on your bathroom scale. Sorting out a mental health concern is not something to attempt on your own. You won't find a bipolar disorder by looking at a thermometer. Like many other health conditions, help for mental illness takes professional diagnosis and treatment. Anxiety won't just go away under a stick-on bandage. So the sooner you seek treatment, the better. If you or a loved one has a mental health concern, don't go it alone. Find out what to do. For 24-hour free and confidential information and treatment referral, call 1-800-662-HELP. Learn more at samhsa.gov/support. That's samhsa.gov/support.